Hello, everyone. My name is Michel, for those who don't know me. Thank you very much for joining us today to listen to Dr. Kevin McFarthing, who will update us on the drug development landscape in Parkinson's. I would like to remind everyone that this session is for information and education purposes only. So if you are seeking medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, you should really consult a medical professional. There will be time for questions at the end of this presentation. Please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen, and please do not use the chat function for questions. It's easier for me to handle the Q&A side. So a few words about us. Many of you will have heard this before, but for those who do not know us, I just wanted to tell you the following, that Mark Lambert, who you see as a co-host with me today, and I met at a tutorial on nutrition and Parkinson's in the summer 2020 and decided to stay in touch. We've become quite close friends since then. We named our small group No Silver Bullet to reflect our belief in the need for a holistic approach to managing your symptoms. And since then, we've been hosting external speakers every few weeks to help us think holistically about the various ways of managing our symptoms. We post the recordings of our sessions on our YouTube channel. If you want to have a look at where to find it, it's on the chat. And we also have an Instagram page and a Twitter feed. But let's come back to today's topic and to Dr. Kevin McFarthing, who will update us on the drug development landscape in Parkinson's. Kevin will give us an overview of research and clinical development for Parkinson's, starting with an overview of trends. The 350 plus active projects, which is an amazing number, will be categorized by their position on the road to the patient, to us, and the objective, whether the objective is for symptom relief or for disease modification. Finally, some exciting options will be discussed in more detail. A few words about Kevin. Originally a PhD biochemist, Kevin's career included R&D leadership positions in life sciences research products with Amersham, diagnostics with Serono, and consumer healthcare with Reckitt Benckiser. Kevin is also the joint editor of the clinical trial highlights section of the Journal of Parkinson's Disease, and he is a member of the research committee of Cure Parkinson's. Kevin also collates the Parkinson's Hope List, which is a database of potential therapies that are either in research or clinical stages. Interestingly, Kevin was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2012 at the age of 55, the same age as I got diagnosed. So like us, he has a very strong vested interest in this topic. So Kevin, the stage is yours. I will let you just highlight, take us through your presentation, please.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for the invitation to join you this evening. Right. Tonight, as Michelle just mentioned, I want to talk about some trends and how important Parkinson's is to the companies who are developing drugs. I'm going to throw lots of numbers at you, which I don't expect you to remember by heart, but it will give you an idea of the trends and the size of some of the areas that are being looked at. And of course, as Michelle mentioned, the recording is available on the YouTube channel, and I'm quite happy to make the slides available as well. And then finally, talk about three options and give credit to dogfish, lizards, and chaperones. You've heard about my background from Michelle. Some of the brands that you see here are brands that I had responsibility for at one point or another. But moving on to the substance of tonight, the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development in Boston do regular studies of the pharmaceutical industry. And when they look at how drugs are developed, those drugs which target the central nervous system come out to be much tougher to develop than other disease areas. So it takes an average of over $2.5 billion to invest in your systems to produce one FDA-approved drug. CNS drugs take longer than average, less likely to succeed, take longer to gain regulatory approval, and are less likely to be offered a priority review by the FDA. Priority review targets those therapies that the FDA deemed to be of most importance. So with that background, you might think that companies are not really interested because it's tough. However, when you look at the trends for Parkinson's, the prevalence is increasing. It's primarily a disease of old age, even though lots of us are diagnosed before we would class ourselves as being old. And you'd expect the prevalence to increase as the population, average age of the population increases, which is happening in most of the Western world. But it seems to be increasing, the prevalence seems to be increasing faster than you would expect from if it was all just down to old age. It's a chronic condition. It's not like a bacterial infection where you would take perhaps a 10-day course of antibiotics and it's cured. Most of the symptom relieving drugs available and those under development, we would have to take on a daily basis. So that's attractive to the pharmaceutical industry. And there's currently no silver bullet, no cure, no single product or therapy that will suddenly take us back to where we were, or at least halt the progress of the disease by addressing the underlying biology. So that is also a very big opportunity for the industry. And even if such a cure, in inverted commas, was developed, at this stage, it's still likely to require daily or possibly monthly medication. So we're on it till we die. So that is, of course, very attractive to the industry. You can't read this probably in great detail, but there's a company called Pharma Projects. When Pharma Projects review the R&D status in the industry every year, they produce a list of the most important disease areas for Parkinson, for the pharmaceutical industry. And as you can possibly see, Parkinson's is down at number 21. Having said that, if you take out all of the cancer indications, Parkinson's is at number 7. And since the last Pharma Project survey, when Parkinson's was at number 4, excluding cancer, you might think that that's quite a drop from number 4 to number 7. But two of the top 6 are COVID treatment and COVID prevention, which is not surprising given the impact that COVID has had on the world in the last 2 or 3 years. Now, I lost my cursor. What's also interesting is the total number of academic publications on Parkinson's. And the source for this is Simon Stott's wonderful Science of Parkinson's.com. So from just over 8,000 in 2019, we're above 11,500 in 2021. So despite COVID, the academics are still doing an awfully productive amount of work on trying to understand what goes on with Parkinson's, what's causing the problems that we experience, and what the underlying biology is. So that is a very positive trend. When I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I used my rusty biochemical knowledge and enlisted the help of Dr. Google to find out primarily what was under development in the Parkinson's field. So I ended up with a list in Evernote, which then became an alphabetical list in the spreadsheet, which then developed even further to become the Parkinson's Hope List, which is a list of everything that I can find which is under development for Parkinson's. And it's easily found at bit.ly/Parkinson's Hope List. And within the Hope List, I wonder how, you know there's over 350. The actual number in the latest edition of the Hope List is 362. And I put an asterisk there to say at least 362, because these are the ones that I've been able to find. And in addition to those 362 active projects, over the years, I've mapped over 200 inactive and approved projects, things that have been on the list but have fallen off, either through active cessation of the project, companies going bust, but there are some approved projects, regulatory approved projects, that have made it to the marketplace. So to me, 362 is a phenomenally large number that shows how much is actually going on with Parkinson's. This is the summary sheet of the Hope List. The only thing I want to point out here is not the details in the writing, but at the bottom, the tabs. The page you can see now is how it works, how the list works. Then there's a summary page, a page listing all the projects that are in the research stages, that's discovery and preclinical. The ones that are in the clinical stage, that's phases 1, 2, and 3, and those that are either inactive or approved. So when you will first open the hope list, the tabs at the bottom may not be immediately apparent, but persevere and you'll find them. And this is a screenshot from the research section of the hope list. This goes halfway through the company's beginning with A. So this gives you an idea of what it contains. So it has the company, the therapy, what it is, what the status is, what the objective is, whether it's disease modifying or symptom relief, and the type, whether it's a new chemical entity, it's cellular, it's a repurpose, it's a reformulation, etc. And with a link to find out more details about the project. So there are three things that roughly that we can try and do. Relieve the symptoms, retard disease progress, slow it down or stop it, and replace what's been lost. And the latter two, stopping or slowing disease progress and replacing what's been lost, we class as disease modifying. And of the 362 projects, 130 are looking to relieve symptoms, and 232 are looking to modify the underlying biology of the disease and retard or replace. So that's a good balance. We already have some reasonable drugs available to help relieve symptoms, but as we all know, they aren't perfect. So a lot of the projects to relieve the symptoms are aiming to redress some of the problems that we experience, like dyskinesia, for example, wearing off. Now, this is a very complicated slide. I'll take time to go through it. This is the route to the patient. From the research side on the far left, where research is primarily in universities, will look to try to understand the basic biology. What goes wrong? How can you intervene? And then when you find an interesting target, you look to screen lots of compounds to find which of those compounds will actually interact with the target and produce the effects that you're looking for. So in the pre-discovery stage, alliances between companies and universities, or sometimes just companies alone, been able to find 13. There are many more projects going on between universities and companies, sponsorship of PhD students, funding of postdoc workers, but active announced programs are at least 13. And in the drug discovery area, there are 78 projects that have been able to find of primarily companies aiming to discover new drugs, which they can then take to the next stage, which is preclinical. A preclinical stage is when you try to find evidence through animal models, cellular models, other models, which say this drug is likely to be effective, it's likely to be safe, it's likely to be stable, it's likely to have the right profile of pharmacokinetics. That's what the drug does, the body does to the drug, and pharmacodynamics is what the drug does to the body. And in this stage, there are 105 projects. So total there of 183 in the drug discovery and preclinical stages. And once a project has successfully passed the preclinical stage and the regulatory authorities have said, yes, it's okay to go into people, then the clinical trials start. So phase 1 usually starts with healthy volunteers to make sure that the first in human trials are safe and the drug doesn't cause any severe unexpected problems. If that works, then the later phase one trials will look at the safety and tolerability in people with Parkinson's. And in phase one, we have roughly at least 67 projects that I've been able to find. So if phase one works, there might be some signals of efficacy, but nothing that you could say for definite. It will be statistically significant, certainly. So then you move into phase two, which still has a focus on safety and tolerability, but brings more of the efficacy question into play as well. And again, usually in phase two, you might start with an open label trial. And an open label trial is when the patient and the health professional know which treatment you're on. And if that's successful, then you move into double-blind, randomized controlled trials where both assessor and participant are blind to the therapy they're on, whether they're on the active drug or whether they're on placebo. And at this stage, there are 81 projects in phase two. And if phase two is successful, then that's when you need to find the big money, because phase three involves relatively large numbers of participants, relatively high expenses, because what phase three is about is trying to prove statistically and clinically that your drug is going to work, it's going to be safe, and it's going to work effectively enough to be of value to the patient, to the health provider, to the funder, and to the families of the participant as well. And in phase three, we have 17. As you can see, that's tailing off quite significantly. But then when the phase three that are successful come to the NDA stage, which is new drug application, and that hopefully results in an FDA-approved drug and an EMA-approved drug and all the other health authorities around the world. Now, the numbers of compounds that are listed here and the number of years are the pharmaceutical industry average based on numbers from the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. With Parkinson's, we don't really have an average number of patients per trial, but that number obviously exists, but it doesn't necessarily relate in the same way to the numbers on this slide. With something like a stem cell trial, you'll have fewer people involved because undergoing brain surgery is a bit more complicated than taking a tablet. So the number of participants in more complicated delivery therapies, you would expect to be less than straightforward dose forms. But that's the overview of where we are in terms of number of projects at the relevant stage of the drug discovery and development process. Oh, yes, sorry, I forgot. There's one FDA-approved drug that's on my list. So, sorry, FDA, it's one project, one therapy is in the review stage at the FDA, and that's Supernus's apomorphine pump project, subcutaneous apomorphine. When you start a clinical trial, it's good clinical practice to register it either with clinicaltrials.gov in the US or the World Health Organization's ICTRP, the International Clinical Trials Registry Platform. And that's where a lot of the data I'm going to talk about in the next few slides comes from. A word of warning though, Just because a trial appears on clinicaltrials.gov doesn't mean to say that it meets regulatory good clinical practice and safety standards. It's a registry rather than an approval mechanism. So there are lots of things that go into clinicaltrials.gov or the ICTRP that maybe not as straightforward as you would prefer. Most of the trials that I've seen for Parkinson's are good. But please bear that in mind. And we've used that data. I'll mention this first. If you go into clinicaltrials.gov and you search for current active clinical trials for Parkinson's, there'll be two classes. Interventional, that's when you clearly make an intervention. There's clues in the word there. Whether that's a drug therapy, whether it's exercise, or whatever, you're changing something and looking for an effect. Then there are observational studies. So observing, for example, the progression of particular symptoms in a particular subgroup of people with Parkinson's. When you add all of these together, you get 858 registered trials. And as a point of reference, I thought I'd just search some other disease indications to see how we fare. And Alzheimer's has 824. Type 2 diabetes, 1,341, and rheumatoid arthritis, 512. And these are all diseases or indications that are above Parkinson's in the PharmaProjects table I showed earlier. So they're in the top six. But still, we have a very large number of trials looking to generate knowledge and to generate options for treatment in Parkinson's. For the past 2 years, I've worked with the Cure Parkinson's, Michael J. Fox, with Gary Rafaloff, another Parkinson's research advocate, and of course the wonderful Simon Stotz there as well, senior author. We've analyzed the drug therapies in the clinical trial pipeline using registered clinical trials. So this doesn't include those projects where, for example, phase one has finished and phase two is in preparation. You won't find an active trial on clinicaltrials.gov, but you will find it on the hope list. But this is just registered clinical trials. We did the first paper in 2020, and this is the 2021 update. It's an open access article published in the Journal of Parkinson's Disease, so it should be relatively easy to find. And if you have problems, please let me know. And if we look at the ST, which is symptomatic therapy, and DMT, which is disease-modifying therapy, we can see that if we look at the totals, in 2020, there were 145 trials registered, and in 2021, 142 trials registered. These are drug development trials, not all interventions. And you can see that most of the clinical trials are for symptomatic therapies. We have 83 in 2021 compared to 59 for disease modifying. One heartening thing from these numbers is that despite COVID, the number of trials between 2020 and 2021 that are in progress are broadly similar. And there's not much difference between 145 and 142. But there is one thing that stands out very strongly, to me at least, and that's the phase three problem. In our 2022 update, which has just been submitted to the Journal of Parkinson's Disease, there are 22 programs in phase three. But only three are potential disease modifiers. Exenatide, which I'll talk about a little later, Memantine, which is a small trial going on at Wayne State University, and Lingzhi, which is an extract of a Chinese mushroom, which has been in phase three for a couple of years now. And we thought it had fallen off the list because the status had reached unknown, but it was updated recently, and so it's underway. So phase three being the pivotal stage, we need projects that are in phase two to move quickly into phase three and to get those phase three studies done as quickly as we can. Also in the Journal of Parkinson's Disease, there's a section called Clinical Trials Highlights. This is a section that I edited together with Professor Tania Simuni from Northwestern University in Chicago. And this has reviews of individual trials. In the editions that we've published reviews, we've looked at, for example, targeting alpha-synuclein, GLP-1 agonists, infusion therapies. So as well as the individual trials being reviewed, the groups, the categories of trials are also reviewed. And in the last edition, which was published in January, I think it was, we wrote a paper summarizing the up-to-date status of all of the groups that we'd reviewed previously. So that actually contains a summary of the status of each of those categories. Well, it takes a lot of money to do this. And these are just a couple of headlines which shows some of the money that's been going into Parkinson's. And Novartis has linked up with UCB in the project that could cost up to $1.5 billion. And Sanofi have invested in a preclinical project looking at Parkinson's again. A new company called VancoBio raised $85 million. GSK and the University of Oxford are looking at $40 million to study Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and other neurodegenerative diseases. And that's a research and discovery alliance. But it doesn't always go right. So last year, Venglustat, which Sanofi were developing, failed its phase two. And it was culled as a result. Biogen got so-so results with an anti-synuclein, anti-alpha-synuclein antibody, and had to write down the investment by $75 million. Sio stopped a gene therapy program, and Humanity had a phase one put on clinical hold by the FDA. And as often happens with small companies, if your progress stops, you need to reduce cost pretty dramatically. And they had to cut a lot of the workforce, unfortunately. Now, that's the time of the presentation to talk about dogfish, Gila monsters, and chaperones. Slight diversion and digression, but do you know how dogfish got their name? Apparently they hunt in packs. They have spiny, poisonous projections on their front fins and sweep through shoals of fish, killing them. So the collective noun for dogfish is a troop. Now, why do you think I'm mentioning dogfish? Well, more information on dogfish. I forgot about this slide. They can live as deep as 900 meters in the ocean. And the final point on this slide is the important one. The dogfish liver produces squalamine. Now, squalamine is an aminosterol, for the chemists out there, that prevents sticky alpha-synuclein aggregation by inhibiting the binding of alpha-synuclein to the cell membrane. And this is one school of thought of the role of alpha-synuclein in Parkinson's, that the monomer, the single molecule of alpha-synuclein, can group together to form oligomers, 5, 6, 7, 8 molecules together, small fibrils, eventually finding large aggregates of alpha-synuclein fibrils, which form a large part of what are called Lewy bodies, inclusions inside the cell, which are thought to come up the works. I don't think anybody's debating the fact that alpha-synuclein and alpha-synuclein aggregates play an important role in Parkinson's. But there's another school of thought that says the reason Parkinson's develops is because alpha-synuclein is no longer available to fulfill its normal cellular function, the so-called loss of function, rather than the gain of function model, which means that alpha-synuclein gains the ability to precipitate and clog up the cell. But squalene prevents that aggregation. But it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So then the question is, how is it going to work for the primary symptoms of Parkinson's? Well, there's an alternative. Sorry, just for those people who may not be familiar with it. The blood-brain barrier is a specialized network of cells that surround the blood vessels that feed the brain, that over thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, we have evolved to protect us from perceived molecular threats. So not everything can pass the blood-brain barrier, but for a drug to work in the brain, it has to get across this fence. So the solution for squalene initially is to target the enteric nervous system. And the symptom specifically that is being looked at is constipation. We all have what you might call a separate nervous system in our gut, which controls the movements and everything in the gut, and everything we're not aware of in our conscious. So, and the company developing this is Enterin. And they have recently done the CARMET study using a synthetic version of squalene known as NTO1 or Kenterin. The previous study, which was called RASMET, was a phase 2 open label study. And all of the symptoms that they were looking at produced results which were moving in the right direction. So now they've conducted a phase 2B, a double-blind, placebo-controlled study in 150 people with constipation. They've also looked at subsets of that group who suffer with Parkinson's disease psychosis and Parkinson's disease dementia. It was 25 days of treatment, which involved an initial phase of titrating up to a level of NTO1 that produced good results. Then 2 weeks on placebo and 4 weeks washout. And they were measured at the end of that 6 week ending phase. Results were announced at the end of January, and I'm pleased to say they were very positive. There was a statistically significant increase in what they called complete spontaneous bowel movements against placebo. Now, the groups of people with psychosis and dementia were relatively small, but again, there were very strong improvements in the scores that measure psychosis and dementia. And what I think is the most exciting part about this is that the improvements persisted 6 weeks after stopping the drug. Now, this suggests, does not prove, but suggests that NTO1 or squalene is having a disease-modifying effect. And I think looking at drug projects like this, we may see ourselves in the future not taking one therapy to slow or stop the progression of Parkinson's, but a series of therapies, a mix of therapies, which will be targeting constipation, dementia, movement, tremor, etc. Because as we know, we're all different. We all have our own Parkinson's. If you meet one person with Parkinson's, you've met one person with Parkinson's. So we all might need a different cocktail. So this still leaves us with the challenge with squalene of how we can get to the brain. Well, there's a relative of squalene called truduscumine, which also prevents the aggregation of alpha-synuclein. and it does cross the blood-brain barrier. So I look forward to a project which is looking at truduscamine. Now, another question for you. What is the collective noun for a group of lizards? Next question is, how many of you have heard of the phrase lounge lizard? Well, surprisingly, the collective noun for a group of lizards is a lounge, which surprised me as well. Now, this is a Gila monster, which lives in the southwestern part of the United States. The bad news is that its saliva contains very, very dangerous and potentially fatal compounds. So if you get bitten by a Gila monster, it's bad news. The good news is their maximum speed is 1 mile per hour. So hopefully you'll be able to run away in time before their mouth gets hold of your flesh. And the importance of the Gila monster comes from its application to type 2 diabetes, which is resistance to and lack of insulin leading to high blood sugar. And there's a peptide called glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, which reduces blood sugar levels and by enhancing insulin release. The problem is it has a very short half-life in the blood. So the Gila monster, with its venomous saliva, also contains a molecule called exendin, which is a GLP-1 agonist. Agonist is something which does something positive, the positive action of the drug, with a much longer half-life in the blood. And so over the years, companies have invested a lot of money in developing versions of exendin with a longer half-life, better clinical profile, better safety profile. So to today, there are many GLP-1 agonists on the market for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. Excuse me. And nearly all of them are injectables, but semaglutide, the one on the bottom left there, recently developed a tablet version, which is obviously much easier to administer than an injection. But the interesting news is exenatide, one of those GLP-1 agonists, is neuroprotective. And results that were announced last month show that liraglutide, another GLP-1 agonist, which had been tested in a phase 2 project, was shown to bring significant improvement in non-motor symptoms, which was a secondary outcome measure in the trial. And was very close in the phase 2 to giving significant results in the UPDRS assessment of motor symptoms. So there's been quite a lot of work done on exenatide in Parkinson's. And the latest the results we have is from a phase 2 study. This was over 12 months, with weeks 0 to 48 with treatment and week 48 to 60 with no treatment. And the blue line is exenatide and the red line is placebo. It's probably best to look at the graph on the right, which shows the progress over time. And as you can see, the gap between placebo, which is obviously continuing normal progression, and the active exenatide is quite significant. It goes back slightly after stopping the treatment, but this is sufficiently encouraging to invest in the establishment of a phase 3 study, which is ongoing at the moment, led by University College London, in 200 people who will have 2 years of once weekly treatment, once weekly injection of exenatide, which is aiming to complete in a couple of years' time. And there are other clinical trials going on for GLP-1 agonists around the world, aiming to find out more information about exenatide, as well as actively testing different forms. So the exenatide trial in South Korea is being done by a company called Peptron, who've developed a longer lasting form of exenatide. And the Baltimore study is done by a company called Neurally, which have a version of exenatide, which again is aiming to increase the half-life in the blood system. Now, chaperones. This is a photograph from the 1932 Olympics of some members of the Australian women's swimming team. And they were being protected by the lady on the left. And in drug development terms, I suppose she'd be very effective at making sure that the girls concentrated on the swimming. But the use of the word chaperone when it comes to biology has a slightly different one. Molecular chaperones assist the folding or unfolding of other structures. Think of it like molecular origami, that something has to be folded in the correct way to look like a bird in origami. And a protein has to be folded in the correct way to fulfill its function within the cell. If it's misfolded or unfolds too quickly, then that can cause a problem. So the sigma-1 receptor is a molecular chaperone that enhances pathways that prevent things that we know cause problems like oxidative damage. It can help promote neuronal growth, and it helps, in summary, to protect neurons, which is very important from a Parkinson's perspective, because a neuroprotective will inhibit further damage to the cell. There's a drug called Anavex 273, produced surprisingly by Anavex. And they've done a trial on 273, which the results of which were announced recently. It's also called blarcamesine. And it activates the sigma-1 receptor, which then gets the molecular folding back into play. In their recent study, that 132 participants with Parkinson's dementia. It was double blind, placebo controlled, two dose strengths compared to placebo. Everybody remained on their current best standard of medication. And the treatment duration was 14 weeks. The primary outcome measure was basically continuity of attention, but it's a computerized system, which is a standard measure of some dementia symptoms. And as a secondary outcome, they measured the UPDRS. Now, for those of you who may not know about the UPDRS, it stands for the Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale. And there's a version called the MDS UPDRS, which is the Movement Disorders Society version of UPDRS. And that measures activities of daily living, a self-entered questionnaire on movement symptoms, and then an assessment of motor symptoms. And there's a part four that looks at dyskinesia as well, and off time. So it's the standard measure of Parkinson's that's used in almost every phase three and a lot of phase two studies. But in this case, it was the secondary measure. And the trial results are quite exciting. There were significant increases in circulating levels of the sigma receptor mRNA. The mRNA is the molecule that makes protein, or that codes for proteins. And this significant increase in levels of the sigma receptor mRNA is proof or strong indication of what's called target engagement. There's a significant improvement in the cognitive measures, the continuity of the attention study I mentioned. But also, there's a 14.5 point difference in UPDRS scores between the high dose version of Anavex 273 and the placebo. And that was after just 14 weeks of treatment. So personally, I find that quite exciting, that a relatively short treatment intervention can produce a relatively strong change in UPDRS scores. We obviously have to have a strong note of caution, because we need bigger studies with bigger numbers, and that has to come in phase three. But so far, I would say so very good. So to summarize, I think we can safely conclude that Parkinson's is a priority for the pharmaceutical and biotech industry. The academic research intensity is significantly increasing. At least 362 drug therapy projects that can find on the hope list. We have a problem with phase three. We desperately need more phase threes. It's tough and very expensive, but the proof is that the investment coming in is also very large. And there are some exciting options in the pipeline that I hope to have shown you this evening. And we can really genuinely have hope. So from the chaperones and the Gila monsters and the dogfish, thank you very much.
Kevin, thank you very much. And it's amazing to see how much animal life may be holding some of the answers to our health, which is, makes sense, but it's still quite a surprise. Yeah. Yeah, I also find very interesting that, as you know, Mark, myself, and a few other Parkinson's patients came up with the name No Silver Bullet. And we meant by that actually medical solutions were not the only solution. There was also health, exercise, and then nutrition, etc. And today you opened my eyes to the fact that even within the medical section, if you want, of the panoply, the protocols that we can follow, even on the medical side, actually, that maybe that we should not expect one single drug, but a combination of various ways of treating our symptoms, which is interesting.
Go on, please.
This is a second layer of no silver bullet, in a sense.
Yes, it is.
Good. Thank you very much. May I just ask you to stop maybe sharing your screen, and then we will take some questions. Thank you very much. I will start with a couple of questions that were sent to me earlier by people by email. Someone is asking us, actually Audrey, who is today present with us, was asking whether anti-diabetic drugs like exenatide are showing promise, she says, for treating PD that you showed us that tonight. But is it the case that they are just effective for people with insulin resistance or diabetes, or would they be helping everyone?
They'll be helping everyone. There is a relationship between type 2 diabetes and Parkinson's. For example, people with type 2 diabetes are more likely to develop Parkinson's than the general population. And some of the pathways that the GLP-1 agonists work on have common faults in type 2 diabetes and Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. But they will be relevant to all people with Parkinson's.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Another question actually is about the ability of psychedelics to promote neuroplastic benefits in PD. And in particular, ketamine is being used in depression, PD depression and anxiety and dyskinesia. I think that Audrey is asking about, she's thinking of the Yale trial, if you're familiar with it, which I think you probably will be.
Yeah. Also, there's a company called PharmaCer who is studying the potential of ketamine in dyskinesia. And another company called Silo Pharma are looking at the potential for psilocybin and LSD in PD depression as well. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I have a question from Ada, who I don't think was able to join us tonight. And she says that at the moment, she's one of the participants who has been dosed with a compound called UB312, which is a vaccinitis experimental vaccine therapy targeting alpha-synuclein, and it is in phase B apparently. And she was asking how long it takes. And I think that you had a chart that was about the path of drugs, the development, and the production to the path to the patient. But she wanted to know, if you're familiar with that vaccinitis experimental vaccine, how long it would be taking before it finally reaches, because it seemed to be doing quite well. How long would it take to reach the patient in the end?
Well, it's in phase one. There are two types of antibody being used in Parkinson's. One, which is what's called a passive approach, where you actually inject the antibody itself to target the alpha-synuclein. And the other is an active antibody approach, where you inject something which stimulates the production of your own antibodies to alpha-synuclein. And there are two of the latter type, one by from a company called AC Immune, who acquired Athiris last year, and United Biosciences, which then became Vaccinity, which is what trial that ADA is on. So assuming successful phase one in, let's say, 2 years' time, possibly 3 or 4 years to do the relevant phase twos, another 3 or 4 years to do the phase three. These are very, very much guesses.
Yes,
we could be talking eight to 10 years. Because it's still relatively early in the process.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Another question from Audrey, which is, she's asking if the is the evidence of NAD boosters like NMN and NR looking positive? I think she's mentioning here NATPARK and NOPARK trials.
Yeah, the NOPARK trial was published recently with good results. So I think there's a, I think there's a strong potential for the NAD pathway molecule like nicotinamide riboside, nicotinamide, to show potential because they actually help to fix some of the problems that happen within the mitochondria of the cell.
Yes.
So I think personally, I'd have to say this is my opinion rather than the definitive verdict, but I think that's quite promising.
Good. Great news. Donna is asking us whether there has been a valid phase three study done on the long-term use of levodopa, which is quite an interesting question.
There has been a study, several studies looking at early or late start for levodopa. It was the L-DOPA, E-L-L-D-O-P-A study done about, probably about 10 years ago, showing no difference in starting early or starting late. So that would have been a study probably over 2 years from memory. And then there's a recent study done by Bas Bloem's group in Holland, in the Netherlands, looking at a similar thing, which was done over 80 weeks. So those are two that I know of. Bearing in mind, levodopa has been around since 1970. The criteria for developing drugs in 1970 was slightly different to the ones we have today. But what levodopa does have is hundreds of thousands and more patient years usage experience.
Thank you very much. And indeed, it has been around for donkey's years, and that's probably one of the main prescribed compounds in the world for PD.
Yes.
Donna had another question about oregano oil, which crosses the blood-brain barrier, and she wondered if there has been any studies that came across your radar screen.
I'm not familiar with any studies for oregano oil.
Okay.
I can't add anything to that.
You can't know them all.
No.
Simon is asking about Bayer's announced UD initiative. I don't know if that's something you've come across. He's basically spelling U with an umlaut. Umlaut D initiative.
I'm not aware of that. I know Bayer acquired a company called BlackRock. They're doing quite a lot of work in stem cell therapy.
Yes. Okay, look, no worries. Simon, if you hear or exchange, if you want to be, either we don't know, or maybe you can be more specific about your question, but probably we don't know. So I will pass that one. That's interesting, actually. Harry is asking whether the work on COVID vaccination has helped in any way in speeding up vaccination against alpha-synuclein. Have we learned something from COVID vaccines that could be helpful to PD?
Not that I'm aware of. It's slightly different challenges because most of the projects of immunotherapy for PD are injecting antibodies to target alpha-synuclein. And in terms of conducting clinical trials, it takes much longer with more patients. It takes much longer in PD to get a readout of a clinical effect. Whereas with COVID, if you're looking at, given the prevalence of COVID infection, it was relatively easy and relatively quick to get large numbers of people to study over a relatively short time to get a good clinical readout. Mm-hmm. With Parkinson's, it's much more difficult. And also, the mRNA vaccines might have some longer-term usage in from a technology perspective in producing or impacting Parkinson's. But the mRNA stage, it's probably more likely to be small interfering molecules which prevent the expression of mRNA.
Mm-hmm. Harry is also asking about antibody development against alpha-synuclein. Is that covered by your previous answer, or is that another angle?
Well, there are like 6 or 7 projects currently underway for alpha-synuclein antibodies. Last week, Abbott announced that they're stopping their program. Biogen stopped their program last year, but then UCB added a program. We still have AstraZeneca, Roche, Lundbeck, and some others still in play in the area. Roche repeating a phase 2 with more numbers than their previous trial.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Donna is asking about mitirosine Demzer and asking whether you have it on your spreadsheet.
Not yet. That's mitirosine was obviously discussed by Dr. Sackner Bernstein.
That's right.
Last time, and we've had a discussion since, and it's intriguing. I would hope to add it to the list when he's got the project fully underway. That's what he's trying to do at the moment.
Yes. Okay, perfect. So it's still a bit early days, but it will be there in due time. Harry is asking about how close are we to having stem cells in practical use? We had the presentation by Roger Barker a couple of months ago, but actually you probably have quite a global view because I know that his initiative is only one of them. How close do you think, Kevin, are we to having stem cells as a practical therapy that we can use practically?
I think we're still some years away because doing trials with stem cells is extraordinarily difficult because, first of all, it involves brain surgery to implant the cells. Because of that, the numbers of patients and consequently data points that you can generate in the study is still relatively low. So you need to do long trials as well. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinarily tough area. So I wouldn't like to predict if or when it's going to hit the streets.
Yes, it's quite invasive.
Yeah.
Okay. So a question from Paul. Hello, Paul, first of all. Paul is asking us if any research has been done on symptomatic relief in PD with cannabis, which is already approved for MS and certain types of epilepsy.
There's a big study that's starting, that's being funded by Parkinson's UK, to look at CBD in Parkinson's. So there've been lots of studies done, but as far as I'm aware, they haven't done the studies which have been done to, you know, double blind, randomized, placebo controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Parkinson's UK is seeking to do.
Good, exciting. Okay. Question from Stephen Motto. Stephen, hello, good evening. Some work, says Stephen, was done on doxycycline and PD a few years ago in South America. And he's asking whether you have heard any latest research on this chill drug and how effective it might be for PD.
I think there's a trial in the hopeless for doxycycline. I'll have to look that one up later. But I seem to remember reading something about doxycycline, clarithromycin, and other antibiotics that have some potential for use in Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. There's concerns about the spread of antibiotic resistance by using antibiotics in an area where they're not necessary, to kill bugs, that is. But there might be some ways of getting around that. But I'd need to check on the database for the doxycycline.
No problem. I also wanted to say that actually, thank you, Simon, for sharing the information on Bayer. I'm making a copy of it right now in an email to myself, and I will send it to Kevin so we can basically look it up and come back to you.
Yeah.
A question from Sarah. Hello, Sarah. Is there anything we can do to boost our own GLP?
Ooh, good question. I don't think so. I don't know, but I'd be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if exercise increased it, because exercise does good things for most molecules.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we do a lot of that. And I think that when we were talking back a few days ago, I was just off from lifting weights. You were just off from cycling on your back. So we are practicing what we're preaching.
Definitely.
Question from Donna. She's first of all saying, thank you very much for the Parkinson's hope list. And she's asking a technical question here about the way you track the changes in companies' names and buyouts for the same drug over time.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I mentioned the acquisition of Afiris by AC Immune. And I usually try to put into the company's name brackets formally and then insert the previous name. But it doesn't always work. But it can be confusing.
So you try to track it as much as you can.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, a couple of questions from Audrey. She's asking, what is the difference between phase 2A and phase 2B clinical trials?
Usually phase 2A are open label, so everyone knows what's being delivered, whether it's placebo or active. And phase 2B, usually with larger numbers and placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized.
Thank you very much. I see a couple of questions appearing on the chat. I'm just asking you, please, to the participants, can you please put your questions on the Q&A section, because I can't track both of them simultaneously. So we have time. You still can cut and paste from the chat if you have put questions there, and put them on the Q&A, please. From Dietrich. Hello, Dietrich. Yes, he basically is asking whether we expect DMT being rolled out for us being already diagnosed in several years. He seems to remember that early diagnosis and treatment would be essential for this drug.
Several things there. First of all, a few years ago, if somebody was developing a phase 3 trial or a disease-modifying therapy, they'd want to test it in pre-medicated patients. So newly diagnosed, drug-naive, because that was felt to be did have the biggest chance of providing a difference to placebo. I think the reality is now struck that to get those numbers and to keep people off medication while the drug is being administered and for long enough to see an effect is not very practical. Is not practical enough to do that. So from what I've seen recently, plans for phase 3 and projects for phase 2 are taking patients that have already been diagnosed. So the trials are being done on people, on people who are already taking medication, I should have said. Obviously, they would be diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So it's people with a positive diagnosis of Parkinson's against a specified set of criteria. There's usually age specified. Maximum and minimum, but the trials that will be relevant for those of us who have been diagnosed, and with the successful drugs coming out, they will be relevant for those of us who are currently diagnosed.
Thank you, Evan. A question from Michelle about photobiomodulation, infrared light. I use it every day. I should be able to say it. Photobiomodulation, infrared light therapy. I know there have been trials in Australia that I remember reading about, but at the same time, my own neurologist told me that there was no trial proving it works. What is your opinion about it?
It seems to be one of those things that unless you have to spend a lot of money, it's unlikely to do harm. So if there's a chance that it works, it may be something people might want to explore. But yes. Again, I'm not aware of any randomized trials. Actually, it's difficult to do a placebo control with something like this.
Yes.
The lights are either on or they're off.
Or maybe they turn green.
Yes.
Yes. So Audrey is asking us about have there been any trials? This is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think there is some sense in that question.
Of course.
Have there been any trials on placebo effect?
That's one of the problems or good things, depending on how you look at it, with Parkinson's, is that quite often placebo generates a strong effect, which makes it difficult to distinguish between the active treatment and the placebo.
Yes.
And it is quite a challenge for people doing trials with Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
There was one study done by, I'm trying to remember the name of the company, looking at a placebo effect for Parkinson's, but it didn't complete. And again, it's almost like a catch 22. How do you control for a placebo study?
That's a good one, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
Nevertheless, I mean, I'm sure that actually we're all sensitive to what we are being told about our chances of delaying symptoms or slowing down progress. Yeah. And a positive mind is definitely helping everyone fare through this much better. Well, exactly. Definitely. Donna says the mind is a powerful thing. I fully agree with you. Exactly on the same page.
Yeah, definitely.
I have a question here about hydrogen therapy. I don't know if it's something you're familiar with.
Yes. I'm familiar with, I think it was hydrogen infused water. There is one project on the hope list. Again, I'm trying to remember the company and the details. But I mean, the rationale is hydrogen as a potential reducing agent could counter the effect of antioxidants. I probably don't know enough about it to give an opinion.
No problem. Look, Kevin, I think that we're getting to the end of our questions. It was a very stimulating presentation, first of all, but also a very stimulating set of questions and answers from our audience and from you. So thank you, everyone, for this. I think you're probably one of the best sources worldwide of information on what is happening in the Parkinson's research world. And I'm very thankful for you coming today, Kevin, to present it to us. We might ask you to do this maybe on an annual basis, because I think it is a very moving target, and it would be nice to keep this with the finger on the pulse, not just once, but over time.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night. Have a good day, wherever you're calling from. And I will see you in a month's time. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.